Honorable Horn, who is doing some party work. Honorable Self also is not around. Honorable Breitenbach will be leaving at 20 past 12. And I don't see other members. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Morning, and morning, everybody. I'm sorry, I need to leave at 22:12.
22:12.
Yeah, and Honorable Self is in hospital. He had emergency surgery yesterday.
Oh.
But he's doing fine.
Yes, we wish him a speedy recovery.
Thank you so much. I will tell him so.
Thank you very much. She is in Cape Town.
Yes, he's in Cape Town. He fell and broke one of the vertebrae in his spine.
Yes.
And so yesterday morning they did emergency surgery to repair that. So he's out of theater. I spoke to him this morning. He's feeling much better. So, but I will pass on the good wishes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we might not be in a position to adopt minutes. Firstly, we would need a quorum, and especially of people who were part of these meetings. Maybe in our subsequent meetings, we would deal with the issue of the minutes. Let's start with the. And welcome members of the SAPS and the members of justice led by Advocate Skosana. I'm not sure from the SAPS, so who is leading the presentation from the SAPS? Is there no one from the SAPS? Can I suggest members, especially our colleagues from Justice and from the SAPS, that we start with the legal opinion because Honorable Breitenbach has to leave early. For a medical reason, that we start with the legal opinion, and then after that we can then go back to the issue of the National Register, because she is the only member of the opposition who is currently in attendance, and because of the nature of this bill, I think it is important that we must retain the multi-party character when we deal with some of these issues. So can I suggest that we start with the briefing on the legal opinion, and then maybe we can start now. Hopefully by, you can check us by 10:30, Advocate Skosana, and I think Brigadier Van Rooyen and Brigadier Wepener. Is that in order?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. So, Advocate Skosana?
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. That's all. That's what I understand, honorable Chair, is that we can reconnect at our past 10.
So you can do your other issues.
Okay. It's in order, Chair. We'll reconnect and I'll let my colleagues online as well.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Okay. SAPS? Um, Since there is no response from the SAPS, we would proceed and we will reconnect with other people at 10:30. So who is leading us with a legal opinion from Parliament?
Morning, Chair.
Yes, Mr. Ntonjeni.
Yes, Chair. I'm currently ensuring that Ms. Ngema is connecting, Chair. She says she's connecting as we speak.
Okay.
Okay, just a second.
That will give us an opportunity for, let's start at 9:55. Let's give her 2 minutes to connect. Honorable Breitenbach, can you lower your hand? Honorable Breitenbach. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's start at 9:45. Sorry.
Hello.
Molasses.
Again. Who turning at Jim Lord on Jim as well? Oh, okay. So good. Lila, anything Lana and things like a phone. Yeah, I network. But anyway, I will use this one. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is Mr. Ngema in? Mr. Ngema?
Yes, Church is in.
Good morning, Mr. Ngema.
Good morning, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Welcome. And can you take us through the legal opinion?
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Greetings to the Chair and the members, as well as every participant on the platform. My apologies, Chairperson. I was in the Transport Portfolio Committee meeting, as I'm also busy with the National Road Traffic Amendment Bill. Chairperson, as you can see on the sprint page, Our opinion has already been given to the members. I just want to preface by saying, Chairperson, in 2018, there was also another opinion that was presented in respect of the Traditional Courts Bill B1 of 2017, which was the bill as introduced by the Minister of Justice. Chairperson, in that opinion, we were also asked to venture a position on the constitutionality of taking out the opt-out provision as was provided in Clause 4.3a of that bill. Chairperson, the legal questions that we were given by the committee through the chairperson looked at two legal questions that we needed to address. Firstly, it was on substance as to whether the bill in its current form as the D version from the National Council of Provinces is actually constitutional in light of it no longer having the expressed opt-out option that was there in the introduced bill. The second part of the legal question was on process as to whether what it is that the committee can do right now with the bill having been passed through the second House of Parliament. Can the committee still propose any further amendments? So those are the two general questions we will be addressing. And Chairperson, I would like to start with the process question one because it's very simple and straightforward. Chairperson, the background history that perhaps I should mention is that there's been a number of traditional courts bills that have been brought before Parliament, starting from 2012. And our first opinion, which was dated 2018 June, is the one that does speak to all the issues as well as outline all the processes and the previous bills that have taken place. So, Chairperson, as I said, under the legal framework, I will start with the process question, which is dealt with lastly on the opinion. In terms of the National Assembly Rules of Parliament, which are found in Part 6 of Chapter 13, the legislative process, the specific one is from Rule 311 up until to Rule 314. Basically, National Assembly Rule 311 sub 2 make it very clear that the Portfolio Committee may not propose any further amendments to the bill if the bill has been amended by the Council. And that is very clear, Chairperson, if one has to look at the object as to why that is the case. That is because if a bill is a Section 76(1), it starts with the first House and undergoes its legislative process, which was done from the time in 2017 when the bill was introduced, when the matter was before the then Portfolio Committee of Justice, until somewhere into the end of 2018 or 2019. So, Chairperson, at the stage that the bill, Traditional Courts B version, is at now, strictly speaking, there can be no amendments that can be proposed to it. And if that is then the case, in terms of Section 312, the rule expresses that we are then supposed, once the committee has deliberated on the proposals of the National Council of Provinces, they either pass and make recommendations through a report that goes to the Assembly. If the Assembly rejects the bill as coming from the National Council of Provinces, then it means there will be to be the process of the mediation where the members that will be allocated into the mediation committee will deliberate on the bill. And if it's then approved at that stage, it will then go to the president. That is the position in terms of process, Chairperson. And this is the process that will be taking place today, the deliberations, and then the committee will prepare a report that is referred to the National Assembly. So in light of the second question, Chairperson, as Sia has put the conclusion part, the Justice Committee must deliberate on the amendments from the Council and report in terms of National Assembly Rule 312. There can be no further amendments made.
Sorry, Ms. Ngema. I think your process is incomplete. your process presupposes that the mediation, after mediation, there will be an agreement. There is also a possibility, theoretically speaking, that there might be a situation where there is no agreement, and can you deliberate on that?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've just given broadly the process. However, if after this process, the assembly rules also do permit that in the recommendations of the committee, once this process is done, then the report that is in terms of Section 312 goes to the assembly, and the assembly approves the bill out of the recommendations of the portfolio committee, then that process will normally end as any process of a Section 76 bill. So, Chairperson, what I've actually explained are two processes. The first process is where, after these deliberations, the committee makes a resolution that it is happy with the amendments as proposed by the council, and then makes a report that approves the passing of the bill. That will be the normal process, and that's where it ends. Once it's before the assembly, the bill is passed, and then it will be referred to the president for assent and proclamation. But the other process is the second leg, Chairperson, which if the report of the committee goes to the House and the House rejects the bill from the council, then the other process will be the mediation process. So I've actually spoken to two-pronged processes, Chairperson. The one where the process is smooth without the need of the mediation process, which is normal with bills that are done and there is not much contestation. But then the second stage is the one where I was just trying to be thorough, Chairperson, is the one where if the House does not agree with the National Council of Provinces, then that is where we go to the mediation processes. So it's two-pronged processes.
Ms. Ngema, what if the mediation fails? That is my question. That is what is not covered by your response.
Oh, Chairperson, if the mediation fails, that would be the end of the bill and the legislative processing like it has in Parliament. It can't even be referred to the President if the mediation fails. Trying to find my rules so that I read the specific rule that speaks to that.
So in simple terms, the bill will lapse. If the mediation
in terms of National Assembly Rule 315, if mediation is unsuccessful, then the assembly decides not to proceed with the bill, and that will be the end. The bill lapses.
Thank you. You can proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will now deal with the question on substance as asked about the constitutionality of the bill. Chairperson, this is the stage where we are going back to ask ourselves what exactly is the exercise of checking the constitutionality of the bill or whether the bill will pass constitutional muster. It is a process that is done looking at the provisions of the Constitution that are related to the subject matter that is being discussed. Chairperson, the substance of the question is founded on whether the explicit or implicit opt-out option by the litigants to use or not use traditional courts will render the bill unconstitutional. Chairperson, that having been said, we are aware that is basically the question why we are dealing with Section 25 proposed amendments on the property clause. So in simple terms, it hasn't been decided whether to be implicit or explicit on an issue makes the matter unconstitutional or unlawful. Now, this is the situation we are faced with today. I pointed out that the bill that was introduced by the minister did in fact expressly and clearly set out that if a person has been summoned after the complaint has been laid with traditional courts, that person can come to the clerk of the court and indicate their option and make a choice. Yes, I'm happy to proceed with the proceedings in this quasi-judicial structure, the traditional courts, or no, I would rather have preferred that the matter be taken to the normal courts as we know them outlined in terms of Chapter 8 of the Constitution. That was expressed to Chairperson. But through the deliberations and instructions of the then Portfolio Committee, that provision was then taken out, and the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor, working together with the department, they made amendments in light of the instructions and the deliberations, and those amendments were presented before the committee, which then accepted them. Chairperson, the question that is before us today is basically in light of what was then presented and what was then changed. It is the question that arises from Section 30 and Section 31 of the Constitution, Chairperson, because those two provisions, they fall within the chapter of the Bill of Rights. So in other words, in terms of Section 30, the Constitution provides anyone with the right to exercise and enjoy and have protection of their cultural rights and practice the cultural rights as the right of choice. So people, that is why there's an argument that to follow traditional style or traditional living is a matter of choice because of what is expressed in Section 30 and 31 of the Constitution. Section 31 makes it very clear that people who want to exercise their cultural rights may not be denied such a right. And it is our appreciation that the fact that today the committee is dealing with the traditional courts bill arises from exactly that fact. The department and the minister, the executive, wanted to give effect with clarity to exactly that specific right. And as we already have legislation that comes from the previous regime, which did legislate and regulate on the running of traditional courts and the jurisdiction of the criminal and civil matters that was given to the traditional courts. So what basically happened, Chairperson, is the presumption that the legislature did make an expression, and today we are making implicitly or explicitly clear what was discussed, intent, and done in terms of the customary law or the common law. It is then clear from that presumption that the intention and reasons of the legislature are required to keep that presumption as to make sure that the law is not harsh, unjust, and unreasonable. So there's been a balance in terms of this bill, outlining with a specific attention to the right to opt in or opt out. So what has happened in respect of the current bill and the position that appears is that the legislature is making it clear that there is a quasi-judicial structure called traditional courts, which is meant to run as a rehabilitative as well as a restorative justice system that is accessible to people where they are. And the person who's been aggrieved or person deprived of whatever it is that they would be bringing to the attention of the traditional court, as a first litigant, they make an option to go to the traditional court and make a report and request that their grievance be attended to. So that person is given a right And the question we should be asking, is that right then not balanced against the right of the other person to make a choice not to be tried in the traditional court? But what the legislation is seeking to do and striving to do once this bill will be enacted into law is to make it clear that as outlined in Chapter 12 and in this state in Section 6 of the Constitution, the right to continued existence of traditional courts and the right to exercise a choice whether you live a traditional lifestyle is available to both litigants or to both parties that have found one another in a space that requires a dispute resolution process. That is why we are then, the bill is very clear that these structures will be done as a Section 34 independent and impartial structures as outlined in Section 34, which is a provision that provides access to courts and access to other tribunals that will be fair to ensure that dispute resolution are resolved. That said, Chairperson, it is then our position that because the Constitution enables the existence of traditional courts, and the certification judgment also pointed out that there is really nothing barring or prohibiting the legislature to make traditional courts either courts under Section 166E or to make them courts as courts in terms of the alternative dispute resolution in terms of Section 34. And the bill is very expressively clear that it is making traditional courts as tribunals in terms of Section 34. Hence, there are other limitations that if we go through the Constitution are then possible. And that other limitation takes me to the second point, which is the legal representation and its prohibition. In terms of Section 34, Chairperson, it is not run exactly in the same manner as the courts that are run according to Chapter 8 of the Constitution. Hence, we have evidence in terms of statutes like the legislation dealing with the CCMA and other alternative dispute resolutions where the right to legal representation is prohibited in total or is left open-ended for the presiding officer after considering the matters and how complicated they are, whether the person should be allowed the right to have legal representation. Arguments have been raised that because Section 35, Sub 3 of the Constitution, in arbitrary matters where the person is accused for purposes of the justice system, it says that people must be given, they actually do have the right entrenched to fair trial, and that includes having the right to a legal representative of your choice or for the state to ensure that you have legal representation in terms of legal aid and at the expense of the state. Now, the department did explain that in these instances, there are many other possible solutions that can address the issue of legal representation or the issue of being presented. You have a choice to choose who can represent you when you are going through the processes of traditional courts. But it is also clear that the prohibition only indicates that legal representation may not take place in light of the person coming before the traditional court as if they are representing you as a legal representative as we know them. But Chairperson, we are also clear that legal representation is an expensive process. There are fees involved, and there's been a lot of research and a lot of documents speaking to the issue that yes, the Section 35(3)(f) may be indicating that every accused has a right to fair trial, which includes the right to choose and be represented by a legal practitioner and be informed that you have such a right. But people at the areas where such traditional courts will be run, it's a given fact. It's people that are in rural areas. It's people that are already living under dire constraints of poverty. So the issue of being able to afford legal fees is not even a question that arises for them, but they just look for easy access and the quick resolution of their disputes. That being the case, Chairperson, it has been argued through a number of court cases, as I outlined in my opinion, that even if we look at the background historical dictates of customary law, legal representation was never allowed in the traditional setting and the traditional court. Therefore, Chairperson, our conclusion in light of Section 35(3)(f), the curtailing of the right to legal representation will not amount to unconstitutionality that may make the bill unconstitutional. And that also arises from some of the court cases that have been reported. Therefore, Chairperson, and as we have indicated, the bill in its current form cannot be found and regarded as unconstitutional on the basis that the opt-out provision is no longer expressly indicated. And secondly, legal representation may be prohibited under the legal certainty as indicated, Chairperson. That is our conclusion. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ngema. Can I now note hands from honorable members who would want to ask questions? I have Honorable Nivod Drachen, Honorable Dennis Breitenbach, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to everyone. And thank you for the presentation. I just want to clearly understand what exactly is meant by the opt-out and opt-in. I'm not clear with regard to that. Can you please explain that? And then what is the impact of each of those choices in terms of the bill? My second question is, if mediation is necessary, who makes up the mediation committee? Is it both from the NA and the NCOP? And then if the mediation is done, who needs to approve the mediation process after it is completed? Is it both houses before it goes to the president? So those are just my questions. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nivod Drachen, Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a second. There we go. Thank you for the opinion. I must say at the outset that I differ sharply with the conclusion. I hold the view that the bill is unconstitutional, and that if this committee goes ahead with the bill and approves it, and if the National Assembly passes it, this committee will suffer the great humiliation of being that Justice Portfolio Committee that supported an unconstitutional bill that fundamentally affects the rights of the vast majority of South Africans. And so I would ask all the members to very, very seriously study up on this matter. Some excellent analysis was sent by the University of Cape Town. I urge you to read it and read it very carefully. And if necessary, we should be able to have a committee discussion on it at a later stage. But I differ sharply with the conclusions drawn in this legal opinion. It's fine to refer to Section 30 and 31 and say that this allows for, justifies the removal of the opt-out clause. The fact of the matter is that it does not do so. There is no voluntary participation in the system that is set out in this bill. Ordinary South Africans, the most vulnerable South Africans, the South Africans with access to the least in respect of everything, so access to legal advice, access to legal representation, access to sophisticated education, those South Africans are going to be the people who are the subject matter of this bill. And they're going to be left with no choices. And those people who do not wish to subject themselves to the authority of a traditional court will have no choice. They will have no choice. They will have to go through the entire process of the traditional court. And then at the end of that, if they're still unhappy, and then they have to go, then those people who have been deprived of all their choices have to go to a magistrate's court somewhere and try and persuade that magistrate's court to hear the matter anew. Imagine the time, the effort, the difficulty, the stress, the trauma of going through an entire process that you object to, that you do not want to be part of, and whose authority you do not recognize. And then you have to go to the existing court and ask them to do it again. They may and they may not. To suggest that the process of a justice of the peace would allow for this choice to be exercised is not true. The justice of the peace in this bill has no power. The only thing the justice of the peace can do is refer the unhappy litigant to the traditional courts, and they must decide whether they can proceed or not. So Honourable, I differ very sharply from this bill, and I would like from
Mr. Honourable Bettenbach. Yes, sorry to interrupt you. I have just been alerted to the fact that due to load shedding, Ms. Ngema has disconnected, so she might not be hearing you, but she is trying to reconnect. Mr. Mthunjeni, is she connected now?
Good day, Chair. She just informed me now, Chair. I'm trying to send the link back to her cell phone so that she can try and connect now. I think we might just need maybe 2 to 3 minutes just to sort that out, Chair. She just, her laptop switched off. My apologies, it's load shedding.
Thank you very much. I'm stopping you, Honorable Bettenbach, because you are raising issues that you feel very strongly about, and we think it is only fair that she must hear them and respond to them to the best
of
her
abilities. Thank you, Mr. I'm happy to wait until she's rejoined and somebody else can have a turn if that's necessary. It's fine.
Thank you very much. I think everybody would want to be heard by Ms. Ngema and to be responded to. So in that regard, so I think it will be better for us to wait for 2-3 minutes so that she reconnects. And most probably we would allow Honorable Bettenbach to start from the beginning.
Why, bye, shame.
Thank you very much.
Ngema?
Yes, I had load shedding and got disconnected.
Welcome back, Ms. Ngema. Are you now fine?
Yes, Chairperson. I'm on the phone, but I missed all the questions.
The question by Honorable Mayvot Drachens, do you hear the questions?
I just got nothing. The first one I picked up before I was off was what is meant by...
Your network is very bad. Can you hear me?
I can hear you properly.
Okay. Can you start by giving Honorable Mayvot Drachens to repeat her question so that you can hear all the questions properly? Because it would not be fair to expect you to give an advice when you have not heard. Honorable Mayvot Drachens.
Thank you very much, Chair. Ms. Ngema, can you hear the interpreter clearly?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what I was saying is that I'm not clear about the matter of the opt-in and opt-out clauses. What exactly is meant by that? And what does it mean for, you know, what does opting in mean for the bill? What does opting out mean for the bill? Next. The mediation process in Parliament, who makes it up? Is it the NA and NCOP members all together, or who is part of the mediation committee? And then let's say the mediation is done after the mediation, who approves the mediation before it goes to the President for assent? Does it go back to the two houses for approval before it goes to the President? Those are my two questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Ngema, did you get those questions?
Yes, Chairperson, I did.
Thank you very much. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember everything that I said now, but I do want to begin by saying that I, again, differ very sharply with the conclusions drawn in this legal opinion. I hold the view that this bill is unconstitutional. And again, I want to draw the committee's attention to the fact that this is a justice portfolio committee. We cannot be the committee that supports and agrees to an unconstitutional piece of legislation and then have it set aside in the Constitutional Court. The humiliation of that will be too much to bear. So we need to be very, very careful. We need to consider this bill very, very carefully. The implications of the bill, the reach of the bill, and the constitutionality of the bill. The University of Cape Town researchers were kind enough to supply us with documentation analyses views. I think those views are well researched. I think that they are worth looking at, and I would urge all the members of the committee to read them very, very carefully and then apply their minds to those views, this legal opinion, and the book. And then I think as a committee, we should have a discussion about the implications of all of those documents. I would like to ask Ms. Ngema, why the previous opinion and this one differ so fundamentally. What has changed? What changed to cause you to change your mind? The last legal opinion found the bill to be unconstitutional. Not a lot has changed fundamentally in the bill. There's no inherent change to the content. And the opt-out clause was included and removed at the instance of Mr. Machecha and the previous committee, something that most of the opposition parties in that committee opposed very, very vociferously. That is still our view. So I want to know why there's such a big difference in the legal opinion. And then I want to know where choice is guaranteed in this particular bill. In fact, in this bill, there is no choice. There is no voluntary nature of participation in this bill. What this bill does, it amends customary law. It removes the voluntary participation. You have no choice. Those people who are going to be targeted by this bill are those people who already have very little in the way of legal representation, very little in the way of access to courts, very little in the way of sophisticated education, and they have no recourse. They are subject to this traditional court whether they like it or not. The only move room, worm room, wriggle room is to go to a justice of the peace, and that justice of the peace has no power. The only thing the justice of the peace can do is refer you back to that court to which you object. And once you've gone through that entire process to which you object and which you do not recognize and to which you do not wish to be subjected, then you must go. That same person who has no access to anything at all must try and convince a magistrate's court to hear the matter and you. The entire process again, the same stress, the same trauma. Again, for what? It makes no legal sense to not have an opt-out clause. If an individual in South Africa in the 21st century that has a very sophisticated constitution and the right of choice guaranteed in the Bill of Rights finds himself in a position where they have no choice, and we, this committee, must say that that's constitutional, I think I have great, great difficulty with that. I would really like to hear an explanation on this. The voluntary nature of the bill that you refer to with the greatest of respect does not exist in this bill. It has been removed. And I'm not at all sure that this legal opinion, and I say this with the greatest of respect, I'm not at all sure that this legal opinion is based on the final version of the bill that is now before us. Because if it is, I don't see how you can talk about voluntary nature of participation when there is none. I'm deeply, deeply troubled by the legal opinion. I'm deeply, deeply troubled by this bill. It's exceptionally patriarchal. It does not acknowledge necessarily sufficiently the rights of women. And it allows no choice. And in my view, that renders it unconstitutional, and there's no way in the world that my party will support this bill in this form. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, we must also bear in mind that we are asking questions of clarity to the legal advisor. We have removed the space for deliberation on the bill. We will deliberate on the bill when we come back from recess. So now we are just trying to understand where the legal advisor comes from, and this is perfectly fine to critique the legal opinion, but we are still going to come back and deliberate on the bill. In the absence of further questions, I'll now hand over to Ms. Ngema. Ms. Ngema?
Sorry, Chair.
Yes, Mr. Mchanjian.
I see she's been disconnected. She's calling me on the other line. Can I get back to you quickly, Chair?
Okay.
Then it means that Ms. Ngema couldn't hear Honorable Brayton back again. Does it mean that?
I was thinking about it, but let's hear from her, because if that would be the case, I would suggest that we run a risk of inconveniencing other people who have other things to do. Because we postponed this presentation until 10:30. If because of this load shedding, Ms. Ngema could not hear part of what was said, I would propose that we would need to postpone her, because at any rate, there is no immediate pressure on us to process the bill and then deal with the bill when you come back, deal with the legal opinion when you come back. Because what is happening now, it is really out of her control. There's nothing she can do. She has tried to change gadgets, but they are also not doing her any favor. And it's something that is out of her control. So if indeed we can establish that she did not hear part of what was raised by Honorable Breitenberg, I will appeal to the committee that we reschedule here. Is that in order?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would probably be advisable. She must hear what we're saying, because she must be able to apply her mind to the answers, and we need to apply our minds to the explanation. So this is, you know, this is unsatisfactory, this position, through no fault of anybody's.
Yes. No, we're not blaming her at all. It is happening to some of us, and it's the effects of load shedding. And Honorable Mufokeng, are you okay with that position?
Yes, I agree, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, no, we have sworn in a new member, Mr. Mthunjeni, as Honorable Member Mthunjeni. Mr. Mthunjeni, can you advise Ms. Ngema that we have rescheduled her? We will contact her when as to when she will be required to come back to the committee to understand her predicament. We would want her to hear everything that is being raised so that she can respond accordingly. Because since it is difficult for us to achieve that, so we think that we will reschedule her and we will invite her at a later date.
Yes, Chair, that is an order, Chair. I will engage with you, because she has just joined, but I will engage on the side that we are suspending her for today and talk with her on another stage. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure, because we are left with 8 minutes. I can see that Advocate Skhosana has not joined. He will be joining at 5:30. Can I check with SAPS? Is the delegation of the SAPS present in the platform?
Good morning, Chair. Yes, I'm Major General Mangale. We are present.
Thank you very much, General. Can we start with your presentation?
Yes, Chair. I will request assistance from Mr. Mthunjeni to flight our presentation, given that we also had experienced the same thing. So we had to join through our cell phones. So our laptops are not really functioning. So if we can be assisted from that, the presentation be flight, then we can talk to it.
Thank you very much, General. Mr. Mthunjeni, can you assist?
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning to yourself, Chair, and the honorable members, SAPS colleagues that are also on the platform, and all protocol observed. The brief was to try and talk to the process of doing criminal record checks using fingerprint as a method to enable to see if the criminal record system will then be able to assist in any way in what you would be considering. So the presentation will look just broadly on the legislative framework that govern the administration of criminal records and the use of the information thereof. Then we will talk also to the spread of the local criminal record center, in particular just to show where the system are accessible. And then we will differentiate between the police clearance and certificate as well as the police clearance report. Then we will just show the process flow between the two. Then we will basically also reflect statistics of the previous years. Then we will also do projection in terms of resource requirements, the challenges that we might have, and then we will arrive at conclusion. Next slide, please. We are covered by those legislation that are flighted there, but I want to drill to say the criminal records has always been governed by the criminal procedure. Then it was amended through the Criminal Law Forensic Procedure Amendment Act 6 of 2010. This in particular gives direction or dictates as to when can we do criminal records and what can it be used for. Thanks. We can go to another slide. Then in this slide, we just wanted to show that we've got 97 local criminal record centers across the country. And of the 97, 60 sites do have the capability of automated fingerprint identification system. Of course, 84 of such have the criminal record system. But in particular, we wanted to show the automated fingerprint system because that's where the fingerprints will be scanned and searched. The report then can be generated in the nearest local criminal record center. So the Eastern Cape, we do have basically 17 LCRC with 7 AC sites. Free State, we do have 7 LCRC with 5 AC sites. Gauten, we've got 13 with 8. Then KZN, we've got 11 with 8 AC sites. Limpopo, we've got 13 with 8 AC sites. Then Mpumalanga, we also have 8 with 5. Then Northern Cape, we've got 9 LCRCs with 5 sites for APs. Northwest, we've got 8 with 6 sites of APs. And the Western Cape, we do have 11 and 8 sites. Thank you very much. Next slide. We thought we need to explain what is a police clearance certificate. It's a certificate that is issued on behalf of the National Commissioner, which is normally used for purposes of international travel or international employment or immigration. So its intended purposes is intended to be used for those purposes. Then we've got a police clearance report. This police clearance report, both of them are basically dependent on a set of fingerprints. This is required for employment within RSA, it's for licensing, it's for permitting, and it's for expungement of criminal records, or any other purpose where there is a need to do a criminal record check. Thanks, next slide. Then we wanted just to show in details the difference to say on the police clearance certificate, we only display convicted criminal record information of the applicant. Whereas on the on the report, we display the convicted information as well as the accused information, all the pending cases. Of course, this does not necessarily imply that if there is an investigation against a person, we will display, because we will not know about such investigation until such time a person is accused of an offense and formally being charged. Then the fee for processing this police clearance is 150 and is 70 rand for the report. The certificate is basically printed on a particular paper with special security features for authentication. It lent itself in another country and there's a query, we should be able to see if it's our own document. This is printed on a normal paper, the report. The processing time for a police clearance certificate, it takes approximately 3 weeks, 15 days, excluding the postal time. And then the processing time for the report, it takes 1 to 2 weeks. It's particularly informed by the fact that it's closer to the applicant. Then the police clearance certificate can only be issued in Pretoria. It's also for security reasons. The signatories on that certificate are also made available to Department of International Relations and Cooperation as well, so that also they, most of the time, they are our contact with the embassies of other countries. And whereas the police clearance report is a decentralized function which can be performed at any local criminal record center, and then the fingerprint will be done at the nearest 80 sites of the 60 sites that we already alluded to. With the police clearance certificate, the information on the certificate must be translated into English. I think the honorable members will be aware that the court has always been passing sentence either in English or Afrikaans. Just also not to distort the information, we have been capturing the results of trial as recorded on the SAP 69, so that, or on the source document, so we can properly account. For that reason, the criminal record can come either on English or Afrikaans, or the language that it was the magistrate handed it down on. So whereas on the police clearance report, the information is displayed in the language that it was captured. So we do not really translate, as we just do it as we have captured. If we can go to the next slide. The process flow for police clearance certificate, an applicant will go to a police station. The applicant will be taken, a set of fingerprints will be taken by a police official on the official form or fingerprint card. Then the completed application, proof of payment, that 150, as well as a certified copy of the ID or passport will then have to be attached. This will then be dispatched by the police station. They can deliver it to the police station. They can post it through post office, or it can be handed over by the applicant at our working area in Pretoria. Of course, it will then be at the courier, and the hand delivery is at the cost of the applicant. Then, upon receipt, we will then register the application, and then we will send an SMS to the applicant acknowledging the receipt of the application, which will then be processed and finalized. Once we have confirmed that it has been finalized, we will again send an SMS saying your certificate is ready for collection. Then the applicant generally will indicate what method we should use. If we are the one that we have to dispatch, then we will use an ordinary mail to dispatch it back. Otherwise, the applicant can collect, or the embassy can collect over the counter, or it can be couriered. Whereas on the police clearance report, the applicant still go to police station where fingerprints will be taken. The applicant will then, next slide, Mr. Mtonya. Thank you. The applicant will then go to police station, take fingerprints, then they will complete an indemnity form that, because this is basically, the indemnity form is basically done, because most of the time this process is done by the prospective employer, or is done by the licensing authority, so that when we give this information to the licensing authority or to the potential employer, that this person should not come back to us and sue us and say, you gave my information without authority, given that although it will be a legislation requirement to give such to an employer or to a licensing authority, but then we just want to protect the state against litigations. Then we will still require that proof of payment, that 70 rand, we still require a copy. Basically, that process on both are the same, except that in the first instance, we do not make anyone to complete indemnity form. The police station will submit the application to the nearest LCSC for processing. The LCSC will process the application. Upon receipt thereof, will return it to the police station of origin. They, or the employer or the applicant, can collect with the arrangement from the police station. Thanks. That's the two processes. We just wanted to show the strength of personnel and the quantities of work that they have been doing in different financial years. One would note that in the 60 sites or the 84 sites that we have been talking about, there's 497 personnel in 2017-2018 financial year, and in that year they did 1 million applications. And 18-19, we reduced with three. Then we did 990,163. And then in 1920, we reduced again to 482. Then we did lesser. I guess there was also an influence of COVID in that particular year. Then if we go to the police clearance certificate, one would note that the personnel is 131, and we did 316,218. Then we reduced to 125. We did 315,287. In 18-19, we reduced to 115. 0825-237-5095. So there's a continuous reduction in personnel there. Then we thought we just display Mr. Mtonjen the next slide. Then we say if we have to consume this function, we may need a lot of additional personnel. We used the teachers, the number of teachers, the nurses, and the police as the basis of what we are calculating now. So we did not go to the social workers. We did not yet go to other people who are frontline. For the purpose of this exercise, we only use the teachers, the nurses, as well as the police to come there. So we were saying we may need, if we use the police clearance certificate, we may need additional 18 million for compensation. Of course, if we need PCR, police clearance report, we may need 90 million. What will be the human capacity required in line with the 18 million? It will be 100 people. It will also imply that we must implement full-time shifts so that people cannot sit on top of each other, because we are aware that space will be an issue. However, if we go to the other side, it just implies that we want to employ additional 485 for the 97 LCRC, which will then translate into 5 per LCRC. Then for goods and services, which would then be consumables like toners, paper, or any other service that we may require, we project additional 5 million on the current allocation and to the LCRCs. Then if we go for police clearance report, then it's additional 20 million. For capital assets, we will require for PCCs, we will require additional 3 million. That would be some desk, some equipment that would be required, computer infrastructure that would be required. And if we go for CPR or PCR, we will go for 10 million. But we want to make this disclaimer that this guesstimate should be subjected to a feasibility study or work study to determine the actual numbers, so that we do not over or underestimate or find ourselves in a situation where we cannot handle the new work. We project that just using the three categories that I alluded to, we guess that the work will increase with 800,000 per year. Of course, as well, the frequency of this application will also play quite a role, whether it's every year, whether it's every second year, or whether it's every third year, will quite become very critical in terms of determining of the resources. Challenges that we may foresee, if we are given this function without additional, we will then have insufficient human and physical resources, insufficient budget. Obviously, it will be an increased workload. We have observed over the year that we have an increased workload. because different legislations require different things. And you may find that if I just give an example with the Road Traffic Act, it requires people to have PDP. But then for employment, they will want a person to also bring along a police clearance report or certificate that must be presented to the employer. For that purpose, you will find that already we issue one or two reports to one person, which then become a multiplier to our workload. There is several legislative requirements that normally would expect us to issue different reports. So the point we want to make is that one. Also, sometimes we would find that a new legislation wants us to display an information that we never have captured on the forms, and that makes it difficult sometimes to keep running with the demand of the legislation. So we just wanted to do that. And of course, the duplication, some people will apply for a police clearance report. And when they see that we have displayed the pending cases, they will then go over and apply for police clearance. Then there, the pending cases are not there. The current issue is the COVID that obviously slowed us down because of we came with social distancing requirement and those compliance to regulations. The technology, the evolving technology become a challenge because sometimes our network infrastructure becomes so inadequate because we are image-based. Fingerprints is image-based. We are heavy on the network infrastructure, and that caused some constraints to the network and slow down the processing time. Of course, I think the human capacity we already alluded to. It will be required, for instance, if we have to increase the AC side to the 97, depending on whether we've got the network infrastructure, then we will still need additional personnel. I think perhaps we must also indicate the fact that some areas only have lesser AC side. In the past, it was more informed by the availability of network infrastructure. Hence, we've got 97 LCRC, but we do not always have all the services at a particular LCRC. Then, in conclusion, Chair, we think that we guide the applicant to apply for the correct and applicable document. I think we will do public awareness to promote and try and make that people not to apply duplicates for two requirements, as well as the potential employers, make awareness with them. For the purpose of this legislation, if we can make an input, we think that the police clearance report should be the preferred because it's accessible, it's closer to everyone, it does not inconvenience, it's economical, as we will be aware that a lot of people that seek employment will need something to show that they are not criminals and so on, and it may be better to use this one as opposed to the 150 cost plus the distance, which will involve additional cost by default. It is our input that it may be a requirement to capacitate the environment, the local criminal record center, with additional resources. Thank you, Chair. I think we have come to the end of our presentation, and we will gladly take questions. I am with Brigadier Baloyi and Brigadier Vepanar. They are also on the platform. And I know that legal services is also around. Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm done with the presentation.
Sorry, I had muted myself. Major General Mangale, thank you very much for the presentation. I had muted myself. I've noted the following members: Honorable Mufukeng, Honorable Nivo Drachen, Honorable Glenis Breitenberg, Honorable Masego Jede, Honorable Kolangola, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much, General, for the presentation. Actually, it makes us to think even deeper about what is coming. We can see that already with the workload that is there, what we are requesting from you with the additional on the National Register for Sex Offenders, it might be a challenge, and maybe you will be able to clarify us. On slide number 3, can I get a clarity on your provinces? I'm looking at Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Limpopo, KZN, and Gauteng. And I'm looking at the level, the total service points. And looking at that, I'm asking myself a number of questions. That's from 97, looking at the 97 centers, and then the service points being 36. And then also you look at the AFIS, where actually that most of the things are supposed to be happening. What can be the challenge here? Why don't you have actually all those places being serviced in the right way? You indicated very well that you have challenges of resources. One appreciates that. But with all the challenges that are coming now, one, I heard you, maybe you'll clarify me, saying that when a person applies, there's a process that you are showing, especially on slide number 6 and slide number 7, the process follows and all that. Now, one thing that was actually worrying me is that you are saying people will get maybe, no, the service point is Pretoria, and most of them will have a courier service or whatever means to get things coming back to them. Are you not afraid that there can be an interception in the process? Why can't we have a system that will make sure that it's, once you have authorized in Pretoria, you can print out on that other side? I mean, it's happening on the vehicle licensing, that you can actually go from one place to the other in the same Pretoria or whatever, but you can still get the same service. And I don't understand this thing, and maybe you can tell us about the challenges thereof. On the issue of the police clearance, you were saying that sometimes when people see their records, they change to be not going to for the police clearance report. They want to go for a clearance. Can you explain that? I think I'm a little bit confused on that. When somebody sees that they are pending cases, where do they see them? When they just jump for the other thing, can they speak to each other so that we don't find people doing what they're doing at the moment? It's clear, you are honest, you have many challenges, but now it looks like you are far from the fourth industrial revolution, because there's a slide that is talking about the evolving technology, and that is worrying, that you are saying actually it's on your challenges, slide number 10. That evolving technology and inadequate network infrastructure. It doesn't look like you are really going to win in this battle. And now the number of employees, actually your personnel, looking at 2017-18 and looking at 2019-2020, now you are already, it doesn't matter whether it's PCC or PCR, you are actually going down. How are you going to be able to cater for now the matters of the National Register for Sex Offenders if it should come to you? Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nivo Trahan.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, General, for your presentation. A few questions. I wanted to know on either the certificate or the report, all criminals or all crimes done is kept a record of, whether it's a petty crime, pickpocketing, to a big serious crime. Does all crimes get reflected? Does it include sexual offences in terms of that, or is it separated? Is sexual offences only given to the National Register, or do you also record those crimes on the report or the certificate? Then secondly, I see I can't myself apply for a person who applied for a job if I have my own business. So the person who applies for the job needs to go himself and apply for the process because he has to give his fingerprints. Now, if I run a creche or a school, I myself cannot apply for that person who applies for the job to see whether they have a criminal record. So I'm not sure if that is a bit vague, because if I apply for a job, I can avoid the employer prevent the employer from knowing my criminal record. So I'm not really sure about that. And then the police clearance, does the police work with the courts, or is it a separate process? And then also, Honorable Breitenbach mentioned in one of our previous meetings with regards to how efficient this works, because the court, you get charged or sentenced, and then immediately that is sent to SAPS. But in your explanation, it's not clear how criminal charges or criminal offences that is committed immediately gets put on the police record from the court. It doesn't really say that. So I just wanted to see how you do explain the process of getting the certificate or the report. But what happens before that is when you get sentenced at court or charged at court. Now, the register for the sexual offences, as Honorable Breitenbach mentioned us, we need that to be as efficient as the police clearance certificate. So can you just explain that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm covered largely by the two previous honourable members. I just have one further question. The issue of the lack of resources has been raised in this presentation. I would like to understand better, is it human resources, so you lack the staff, and does that capacity need to be beefed up? And is it also other resources? So we need to have a good understanding of additional resources required, because I still hold the view that the police register is the correct place to house the sex offenders register, but I need to have a better understanding of what resources are going to be required to make it efficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola.
No, I'm covered, sir. I'm covered.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola. Can you lower your hand? General Mangele and your team.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Perhaps I should start with the questions that relate to the sexual offender register, whether it's going to be additional information or not. We don't share the view that it will be additional work per se, in that prior to a person applying a lot of time for anything with a sex offense offender for removal or so, those people would have applied with us for a police clearance report. So which means at some point we would have handled it, or the registrar would submit the fingerprint to us so that we can confirm if that person does not have pending case or other case that or convictions that came on record. So for that reason, it is not additional in the sense of additional. And also, if one consider that when orders are issued to the registrar, the criminal record report, the what is commonly being known as SAP 69, is then sent to us for administration of the criminal record system. In that administration of the criminal record system, we will then capture the conviction, and maybe this lends itself on the question that the Honorable Member was asking, whether we only reflect the sex of offenses only or all crimes. Currently on the PCR and PCC, we reflect the conviction, all conviction, despite whether it's minor or it's serious or it's sexual offense, it's contact, it's property, we show all of them as decided by the court. However, the development that were made in the past, or the legislation that were the requirement of the legislation in terms of the sexual offense and related matters, if we give to the registrar any information, we will only filter the information relating to the sex offender. And in terms of other matters, the registrar will be well positioned to say what will then happen. But our role was to provide the historic criminal conviction report to the registrar and to confirm whether that person, the conviction is still there, or there are new convictions that came on board, or there are pending cases as it is now. So for that reason, I guess our report reflects all conviction in one way. Of course, sometimes when we talk minor, some transgressions that are not necessarily, how can I say, criminal records, where people are given fines and they're paid before they are even charged, where it's not really seen as admission of guilt, will not appear. Particularly traffic infringements, most of those traffic infringements, if there is no formal criminal case, it will not appear because it's been seen as an infringement. The employer can apply for the applicant, but then the employer have a responsibility to ensure that the fingerprints of the applicant are taken by a police officer, and the employer can submit the fingerprint to us on behalf of the applicant. Hence, earlier we have been saying that when we do a police clearance report, we will require an indemnity form. that when we give that potential employer the feedback relating the criminal status of an individual, that individual cannot come back and say, you illegally issued my information to this person and start to try and take us through court processes. So the employer can, and in many instances, we as government employees, when we apply for promotion or for appointment, during screening or interview process, we get taken fingerprints, we get screened, and the results are basically being given to the employer, not necessarily back to us. It is only when it's required by an individual. Most of the licensing authorities, you will basically apply at a licensing center where your fingerprints will be taken. We will check and we will give feedback to that licensing center. So, but then the onus to take fingerprints still lies with the employer or licensing authority through the police. We have been using the word evolving technology. We have consciously used it because in other countries, the network infrastructure is so good so that they can use live scan and eliminate, for instance, paper, where a person does not need to go to a local criminal record center to submit, but rather when you are at a police station to take fingerprints, and then through network, the fingerprint gets submitted to the local criminal record center, and the administration of criminal records has done that process we have been showing, then the results get sent back there. We are waiting for courts directly in terms of the administration of criminal records. Whether when the courts wants us to present the criminal record report to them for sentencing purposes or for bail opposition, as much as when there is a decision in court, then that results of trial will then be submitted to us and it will be updated. We have not included that process in our presentation because our understanding was not more relating to the administration of criminal record, but it was more on the vetting processes that we should follow should we take over the function that we wanted to unpack for the purposes of this presentation. Of course, in terms of the service points, the number of LCRC, there are many factors that come into play. One will be facilities where we'll be accommodated. It will then be network infrastructure, it will be computers, it will be humans that must man those computers. You may find the reason why we open a service point while we have an LCRC mean it. We try to close the gap between a particular local criminal record center and a remote area. So the only time that we will then make that service point a fully fledged is once the workload permits to have a number of people. Because sometimes you may open an LCRC, when the work study is conducted, then they say, no, that must have only 10 people. Then it becomes strenuous on the process because when the people are unable to handle the work due to sickness and what, then it must be transferred to one place to another. So also one will need to facilities, which most of the time facilities are a challenge to acquire. In terms of the whether we cannot generate automatically after issuing a police clearance certificate, whether we cannot automate that process, it is something that can be explored, but I am a little bit not sure whether I can give a definite answer, because it may require technology management to assist in responding to such automation. Obviously, in terms of the automation, it should not be impossible. It's just dependent on the technology at hand that the police are using, particularly at the end user. We may be at a better position to do it here in Pretoria or in some local criminal record center, but if the bandwidth at the end at the police station is weaker, that may cause trouble. But I think it will be an issue. The human resource capacity, obviously we require additional. One could see that we are going down in terms of the number of people that we have been employing over the years. So it is a requirement that we are advancing to our leadership to acquire. And we obviously know that there is competing requirements as well in terms of the prevention of crime, investigation of crime, and so on. So we are not taking lightly that they will not give, but we have advanced a request to that effect to capacitate ourselves. We are also aware of the compensation budget that is a government initiative to try and down manage it. So from that end, yes, there's an issue with human capacity, which is not an issue that is confined to this process. I think it's just an issue that is there. The police clearance certificate, I think there was a question, why will people switch around? The police clearance certificate will only display convicted information. Whereas with the police clearance report, we display accused information where a person has been charged and the case is awaiting trial. A lot of time, you may find that a person has an awaiting trial. For that reason, for teachers and for government employees, it's for that reason that we do not prepare a police clearance certificate. In any way, we are in a process of reviewing the information that displayed. I think historically, it only relates to convicted information, but we are reviewing that situation to say it must be convicted and accused information, despite what purposes a person wants to use it. If I have covered all the questions, and my colleagues, if I missed, I'm sure they are on the platform, they should be able to respond, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Major General Mangele. Honorable Mfuke.
Chairperson, mine is a follow-up, and thank you very much, General. And I just want to check on the first part. There was a question on sex offenders or a sex offender. And then they said, is it an additional responsibility? And you said, it is not additional in the sense of additional. And I have a problem with that. I really needed clarity. It's not an additional in the sense of additional, because you are explaining the challenges here, which we really understand and really sympathize with you. The other thing that you are raising is that in other countries, you were explaining their successes. It shows that you have been checking, benchmarking, and studying on that. But then why study when you cannot implement? because I've seen even some of the officials who travel overseas to go and look at a model in a country, but they will come back and not do anything about it. Now, this other one is that about the automation. The automation is the way to go. We like it or not, because it's for the betterment of this country, but the principle is very important. Service delivery must happen. But if we want to live in the old time of a manual, we are not going to go anywhere. The last part will be, will you agree with me that you need to have compartments of sections where you know that you are dealing with clearances for this category, so that you know where you are going? Because at the moment, I'm not convinced that if the National Register for Sexual Offences comes to you, as Honorable Breitenbach says, that you are the best, I still know, I'm not convinced that you can still deliver. Well, yes, we have a challenge where it is, but for you also getting it with these challenges, do you think that you can do better? And if you want to do better, what is it that you think must change so that we go forward? Because when you talk to us, it's when you talk about your challenges and what can be something that makes it better. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other member want to make a follow-up? Mayor General Mangene.
Thank you very much, Chair. Perhaps with the word additional, not in the sense of additional, perhaps maybe I should say, I was referring to the fact that either way, when we come to the vetting processes or clearance processes where we have to issue a report, we are currently issuing it. When a person applies for anything with the registrar, that person will start with us requesting information, or the information and the registrar will request us a criminal record report to confirm if there is no awaiting trial cases or other convictions that may affect the decision processes. Hence, I was saying it is not necessarily additional work for us, because we will be doing at one stage, prior or post the process of the registrar. Perhaps we did not necessarily understand the logic why we are presenting, but our understanding was confined to the fact that will we be able to do clearances in relation to the sex offense register, and hence we make the presentation. However, I must say, already our systems, the criminal record systems, have compartments where you will be able to say this is a police clearance certificate, it's a police clearance report, it's a public driver's permit. Those services, the service type is already there. But for purposes of this presentation, I thought it's at operational level where we can share such information. In relation to benchmarking, I think we are benchmarking with the hope when the fiscals and our fiscal infrastructure allows us to move with time. I think there is no argument that we do not want to be better and bring the services much closer to the community. That's what I'm sure we are aspiring to do. And hence we are benchmarking, and eventually that benchmarking will enable as well automation, because as part, for instance, if we implement light scans at police station, that in itself is already automation, because they will know, they will no longer be manual fingerprints that are submitted to the criminal record database for searching, but it will then submit through the network infrastructure. We will search, we will give the results as such. Unfortunately, we are not yet there. If I have, I thought I have covered the four questions that were asked.
Chairperson?
Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, through you.
Honorable Mfuke.
The courier service matter you didn't answer on to, are you having any challenges or you never had challenges? Do you think is the way to go? That is the, that was the question on that. And also the backlogs. Do you have backlogs at the moment? If there are, how many were in which provinces? And also the question that I asked about the provinces, it was never answered. And now I think I will take it that day. It's because of your resources. And I don't mind leaving it that way, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. General Mangale.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Honorable Member, I thought I answered it to say, in terms of the provinces where the service point is in the main because of the infrastructure, the facilities, the things that human resources that we require to make the service points fully fledged. And the in terms of the ACES capacity, that is only 260 sites, of which the 60 sites include the national office. It is the limitation was more on the finances, not to do to all the sites where we've got criminal record systems. So there, I thought I answered to say, as soon as we do work study report, as soon as we've got a facility where we can accommodate people, because you may find in a service point, a police station only gave us three offices where we operate from, and three offices will not be sufficient given the fact that the mandate includes crime scene processing, it includes the administration of criminal records, so and the separation of such functions should be maintained at all times. So for that reason, I thought I answered adequately. The courier service, Honorable Member, we do not necessarily have any problems with courier services. The only thing is that the applicant pay for the courier services. If we also pay in some instances if we deliver work between police station and LCRC or LCRC to LCRC, we do not have any problem. In terms of the police clearance report, we are currently really not having backlogs, but I think in terms of the police clearance certificate, we've got a high workload currently, and it might have been informed by the moving of disaster management regulation from alert level one. Yesterday, we were standing at a workload of 30,000 applications that are on hand, which when we look, we are doing the work of the fourth week, so we are behind what is our target because of that workload. But we will ensure that there are plans to reduce the backlog in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, General Mangale. Any addition from your team members? None. And I don't see any hands or follow-ups from members. Thank you very much, General Mangele. Members, can I ask that we take a 5 minutes break? During that time, we will be making arrangements for Justice to do their presentation and upload their slides so that those slides can be flighted. Can we meet at 12:30?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Are we excused?
No, General. I do think that it's important that we must always understand one another as the whole criminal justice system. So I think that when justice presents, it will be important that you also listen to what they have to say. And I think if we inculcate that culture, we would be able to build collaborations to be much more stronger and break down silos.
Thank you, sir.
Can you meet at 12:30?
Okay, Chair, thanks.